Welcome back to Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name's Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by my good friend Bradley Chambers. This episode is brought to you by two sponsors. Firstly, Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. We've got an offer code from them for a free trial and 10% off. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TECH, that's T-E-C-H. And we're also sponsored again this show by our friends at Jam Software, makers of the great Apple-focused MDM software, the Casper Suite. More information at jamsoftware.com, and we'll tell you more about both of those sponsors as the show goes on. Bradley, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. How's it going?
Yeah, thank you. It's going well. It's going well. The kids are have survived the Christmas rush and the New Year. So parents have just about survived it. I don't know how it's been in your house, but It's been an exciting Christmas and a very iOS-focused Christmas in this house as well.
Yeah, I saw one of your daughters got an iPad mini that ended up being broken.
Hmm. Yes, it was a bit of a torture test for Apple support over Christmas. We got Beth an iPad mini, the non-Retina display model, the A5-based one, because after all, the YouTube application doesn't require anything else, which is her favorite thing. But basically what happened was Boxing Day or the day after, her iPad developed a large black stripe down the middle of the screen. Basically, it looked like a section of the LCD had failed in some way and it was no longer lit up. I'd seen this problem before, actually, on some of her iPad 1s a few years ago when we got them at school. And I guess it's just one of these sort of bad luck manufacturing stories. But, you know, credit to Apple. We took it back to the Apple store. They did a Genius Bar swap for us on the spot, and we're back up and running with the new iPad. So that's score one for the Apple store.
That's the benefit of maybe having the non-Retina one, which I'm sure is still in short supply. You know, there's nothing worse, like if you bought, say, a PlayStation 4 and it was a big rush, yeah, and then the one you get is broken. Because it's not even
I saw a few sob stories about that with people who'd bought, like, the opening day edition, where there was like some special thing you could get, and then it was broken, and then they sent it back and they couldn't get the opening day edition anymore, so they had to stick with the normal one.
Yeah, that's a bummer, but yeah, it's awesome that they got it fixed. So yeah, it's funny like how YouTube is for like the kids, our kids' generation. It's such a different mindset. It's a place that can waste hours and hours and hours, and for me, YouTube's okay. I don't spend a lot of time in the app.
I feel like I only ever open that app in response to somebody tweeting a link into something.
Yeah, my son, my three-year-old likes it. He'll find random shows and go to, you know, through the suggested links, he'll find new shows that he wants to watch. And I don't know, well, yeah, whatever. But
I was always confused by Beth's behavior with the YouTube app, because she would never watch the video full screen. And one day I asked her, why don't you just full screen it? And she said, well, I want to decide what I'm watching next while I'm watching this one, because if you full screen it, you can't see the up next videos on the sidebar.
It's funny that my three-year-old has figured out the ad skip button. I know he doesn't know what it like says, but he's seen us tap it enough times when it's not playing the cartoon that he just, if the video comes on and it's not the cartoon, he just taps in that area until it skips it.
So that's how you get the cartoon to play.
Yes. We are sleep training my 6-month-old, so on New Year's Eve, I went to bed at 9 o'clock p.m., so I could then wake up at 2 o'clock p.m. and let my wife go to sleep. So that was our exciting New Year's.
It's always a good year at some point, isn't it?
In bed by 9. That's how we like to do it at the Chambers household.
So, did you have any holiday projects, Bradley?
I did some more transporter testing. I have actually just ordered the third one that I've not installed yet, so I'll have three, and I'm going to put them at all three different locations and see if I can watch how they kind of share data between each other. And my testing was dropping 5 gigabyte and up files on it and seeing, you know, doing it on one computer and seeing how that interacted with the other computer, how quickly it downloaded, you know, trying things like letting it upload on one computer but not completely download on the other computer and deleting it while it was downloading, from a different location. So say moving a file onto my MacBook Air, letting it sync up to a transporter, let it start syncing on another computer, and then deleting it from the iOS app and seeing how that kind of what happened there. Because Dropbox handles things like that pretty well, where you would think it can kind of cross it up. But so far, it's worked well. I had one conflict, and it kind of basically put two folders on there that said one was a dash conflict, and it worked. So Just trying to put it through its ringer. You know, it's one of those things we're trying to replace some specific workflows with it at work. And if it doesn't work like 100% of the time, we'd be better off sticking with Dropbox. But I'd really, really like to get rid of Dropbox for Teams. I really hate spending $1,000 a year on that. It's just expensive. Well, and we're getting more storage with Transporter as well. We have 2 terabytes and there's no monthly fees.
Well, exactly. I think this is one of the reasons why products like Transporter are going to be popular. I think they are going to be popular because people who are really serious about the cloud are spending a lot of money on, you know, across all the services that they're subscribing to. I mean, software as a service has done nothing but put the price of software up massively. I mean, people think software prices are going down, but it's software not connected to a service that's going down, but software as a service. I spend way more on software every month than I ever did before, just because of these kind of recurring charges. You know, you've got Dropbox, you've got, you know, you might pay for Skype, you might pay for Evernote, you might pay for, you know, GitHub and various other things as well. And I think people are starting to feel a wee bit of the pain of that, you know, because also what's happening is that in some cases they're getting more expensive as well. I mean, Box just put their sort of free tier prices up, you know, so it's not as cheap as it used to be either. Now that it's become kind of part of everybody's workflow, now we're starting to see some of the real costs coming through.
Especially as our data needs grow, you know, Dropbox is fairly expensive when you compare it to, say, Google Drive. And I think the challenge there for Dropbox is Google owns its own servers. So it's basically able to sell that storage at a, you know, I guess at a wholesale cost, where Dropbox is using Amazon S3, and so they've got to buy the space from Amazon and then mark it up to make money on it. And that's their only model is doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's where companies like Backblaze do quite well, is that I believe they have their own infrastructure as well. And of course, Evernote have their own infrastructure as well. So it'd be interesting to see who's investing that kind of level of money to get their costs down so that they can be very competitive. I mean, Amazon have sort of dipped their toe in the water a little bit, but I don't see a lot of people using Amazon services in the same way as Dropbox or even Google Drive for that matter. But you can see a day coming.
Well, and especially, you know, look at Netflix. They, as new customers come online, they don't necessarily have to add more copies of the movies.
Yeah.
And where Dropbox, if they sign a new customer up, they then have to allocate for that space, and it's not like that they can deduplicate all the data. And I think that's where companies that are dealing with pictures and personal media have also run into struggles, is you can't really deduplicate a lot of that stuff because it's unique to every customer, where and it's like iTunes or the Kindle store or Netflix, you know, as they add millions of customers a year, they just have to account for the access, not necessarily more copies of the data.
Yeah, their issue is bandwidth rather than storage.
And so, yeah, doing some more Transporter testing, and then I got a Roku 3 for Christmas, and very thrilled with it so far. I had a write-up on my blog that I kind of compared it to the Apple TV. There are pluses and minuses to it versus the Apple TV. Some of the apps are terrible, because it actually has an app store where you can install apps, and the majority of them, I'd say, are terrible. But I really like the Netflix app on it. I really prefer it over the Apple TVs. You know, the remote is RF, which is a big plus to me because you can hide the box. And the model I got has the headphone jack in the remote. So it's really handy for like late night or early morning TV viewing when you can plug a set of headphones into the remote and not have to wake your kids up. So
that's a pretty cool feature.
Put a link to that in the show notes. But again, really, you know, it's a great media player. Really, really enjoying the Plex app. And we'll talk about that, I know, in a little bit. Really missing like kind of the AirPlay integration. It can read your camera roll and play your videos and movies, and it can actually play your music as well. But it, you know, again, as far as like the integration with every single app you have on your device, it's certainly not there. So again, pluses and minuses. The Roku is a little bit more of a geeky solution, but it's a neat device.
Interesting. Yeah, I know there's at least one company in the UK who are selling a very heavily subsidized rebadged Roku box. I think it's the basic Roku model. It's called something like Now TV in the UK or something, but you can get it for about £10 with the idea that you can then use it to buy into the service. I haven't bought that myself, but it's something that's probably worth looking at as well, because I think you can basically use it like a Roku, but it has some front and center placement of certain services. So yeah, that was that's quite interesting, because you mentioned Plex as well. I mean, one based on your kind of persuasion, one of my projects for the holidays was to install Plex, because I had put down on my list, my to-do list, there was two things I wanted to do this Christmas. One was to sort of fix my iTunes library, whatever fix actually means, and also migrate my blog over to Squarespace 6. And obviously Squarespace are sponsoring this show. I'll tell you a little bit more about how that worked when we talk about Squarespace. But I was doing that anyway, because obviously I've been, well, not obviously, but I've been a Squarespace customer for many years, well before we even started this show. So Plex, right? Plex is kind of interesting, because I have been looking for, as you know from the discussion that we had earlier about when you were looking at Transporter for the first time, I had been looking for a solution to, because what I had was, I've got my MacBook Air and I've got a 2 terabyte drive plugged into it, which had all of the big media from my iTunes library on that, which was kind of a pain, and it seemed to more confuse iTunes more than it helped it, actually, for the large part. So what I wanted to do is, I was looking for a way to kind of divest the movie content that I have from the iTunes library, if you like, and where I was using things like downloading apps or browsing the App Store or using iTunes Match. I wanted to do that on my laptop, but I didn't necessarily want to watch the movies, because in truth, I only ever watch movies on my iPad. I don't watch them on my computer in any way. So based on your recommendation, Bradley, I grabbed Plex and set it up on an old Mac Mini that we have floating around here. And it's been really great. I've been really impressed with it. I've loaded up most of my TV content and a good chunk of the movies that I have. And so far, it's exactly what I wanted. I mean, what did I really want? I wanted somewhere off my laptop to store movies, and I wanted to be able to cache them onto my iPad wirelessly in order to take them on a trip with me. And that was pretty much all I wanted. And Plex basically does that for me. So there's an iOS app, there's this server-side component, and they can find each other and stream movies to the iOS device or cache them wirelessly to the iOS device. And it's worked pretty much seamlessly for me so far. So I'm really pleased with it. I'm hoping it doesn't have the Chamber's Kiss of Death on it after I adopted EverPix earlier on. Within a bit of a month, EverPix were out of business. But I hope, having given Plex some actual money, unlike EverPix, I hope they will be in business for a good long time to come.
Yeah, the server-side app is free, and then there's like kind of what they call a MyPlex login. And so it's not actually storing your data. That's just helping your... It's kind of taking care of all the port forwarding and connecting your server. And when we say server, we don't mean it doesn't have to be like a beefed up server. It can be really any computer, any Windows computer, any Mac. There's a lot of NAS devices it works with, like a Synology, and I think the Netgear NAS as well, along with Robo. Of course, on a side note, I'm looking for like Transporter apps as well. That would be a neat thing to see, is if you could, you know, get apps for that. But that's a side note. And then so that's all free. The iOS apps are $5. The Roku app is also $5, so I actually did give money to Roku to buy that app. And also has a neat thing where you can share your library with another Plex user, so like I can share my library with you and vice versa. Then there's another component, which is the Plex Pass, which what that does is it allows you to cache on a device, such as an iPad, so you can actually, from the web, say, download this movie to my iPad, and it'll push it to it. You get access to all the newest features. You can, I think you get some access to their forums, and there's some other things you get. And then it's, I believe, $4 a month normally, $25 a year, or they have a lifetime for $75. Of course, I think you paid maybe £3 for that based on the conversion rate.
Yeah, I just found some money in the back of the sofa. So, enough to buy the company.
Yeah, you know, what's neat about it is I'm actually using it in conjunction with my Apple TV. So what Plex does, you basically tell it where your media is, and what I pointed it at the iTunes folders that have my movies and TV shows. And so then it kind of watches those folders and it makes those accessible via Plex, which again is on the Roku or your iOS apps or Android apps. And then the Apple TV still sees it inside of iTunes as well. So even if you don't use a Roku, it is actually still pretty cool to have on iOS, because you can kind of stop syncing at that point. You don't have to like sync your iPad through iTunes to store them locally offline. You can just install Plex, get the Plex Pass, and then you're good to go.
Yeah, so I'm pretty happy with that. I think it's a nice solution. I found when I was setting it up that, I don't know if you found this, Bradley, as well, but I found a lot of the default settings were pretty bad. that there was a lot of things that I wanted to be turned on that weren't turned on, or bits that had to be logged into their servers that weren't all logged in at once. I had to go into my server and log that into my account, and then I had to log in on another computer through the web to see it and then log into my... Because I think they have a sort of focus on being able to use it without necessarily having their account. But I think in many ways, if you had to have their account before you could do anything, once you'd done that step, it would actually be a lot simpler to kind of set up afterwards.
That
was probably about a morning's worth of conceptualizing it as well. Because the MyPlex web app actually runs on their server. It doesn't run on your server. And what that does is it basically shows you from any computer where the servers that you have access to are, and you can choose to connect to any one of them and stream to that computer through the web. And that's remote, not necessarily just on the same network, but it can be done remotely as well. So, yeah, all in all, that was a good holiday project. I'll tell you about my other one once we talk about Squarespace.
Why don't we go ahead and take a quick sponsor break before we talk about our next topic. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TECH. That's T-E-C. Chambersdaily.com has been running on Squarespace for a few years now. I've been fortunate enough to have a few links from Daring Fireball, Forbes, Mac Stories, and some other big websites, and Squarespace has never gone down. I don't know if you guys remember during the Hurricane Sandy that came through New York, Squarespace employees were actually carrying diesel up and down steps to keep their servers online. So rock solid hosting, very, very happy with it. So I know, Fraser, you spent some time with your Squarespace website this Christmas. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, I had Spears.org, my website, has been on Squarespace since I can't even remember. I think probably at least 2009, maybe a wee bit earlier. But it's been fantastic, and it's been running Squarespace 5 up until a week ago, just because, well, I knew Squarespace 5 and I could kind of keep it running okay, and I knew how to work it. Squarespace 6 is their new platform that has been around for maybe about a year now, just a little over a year, and I had kind of always tried to kind of sit down and do it, but hadn't really found the time or found the inclination to do it yet. But that was my other holiday project for this holiday, was to finally migrate my entire blog and all its archives over to Squarespace 6. And one of the kind of major motivations for doing that was that they just released a whole slew of new iOS apps, which are really nicely done, but they only worked with Squarespace 6. So I was kind of cut out from using them for a while. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to get it moved over. And it turned out to be pretty easy. I mean, all you do is you sign up for a new Squarespace 6 account, and then you say, here's my Squarespace 5 credentials, go ahead and import all my settings. And I did that. I had a couple of misunderstandings about the new system as I was going through it. And one of the cool things that I discovered is that they have this, when you go to their help page, there's like one of those kind of live chat bubbles, which I'm actually never sure if whenever you see those on the web, whether they're actually a person or if it's some kind of Turing test sort of thing. But this one was clearly a real person because they were nice. And I used that a couple of times to just sort of quickly solve a couple of problems that I had. And it was brilliant both times. You know, you put your name in, somebody connects to you, you chat, you get it sorted. You know, and I had two problems solved in about 5 minutes each, which was great. So, yeah, I'm very happy with Squarespace 6. Been using it for various sites and finally moved my main site over to it over the holidays. New design. I'd love people's feedback on the new design. I used one of their templates. They've obviously got a huge range of templates. I used one of them, tweaked it a little bit to my own taste. Some people have been giving me some feedback about colors that I used. I'm not a graphic designer, what can I say? So I'm going to tweak it a little bit more, but spears.org if you want to see a freshly minted Squarespace 6 site.
Yeah, Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They, as you mentioned, they have beautiful designs for you to start with, and they all the style options you can want. There's a lot of, you can change the fonts, they have Typekit fonts, and it's all done with sliders in their customization. It makes it really easy. As you mentioned, great support. They have over 100 employees on their customer care team, and they're based right in New York City. Their office has actually been nicknamed the Care Bear Lair. It's kind of interesting. But yeah, every time I've worked with their support, I've been pretty happy with it. It's a real person, and they're really out there just to solve your problems. It's just $8 a month. It's not free. It's a paid service, and if you're going to do a professional website, I highly recommend going with Squarespace. $8 a month, and if you sign up for a year, it includes a free domain name. Every template has a unique mobile design, so it's not like some other hosts where they have desktop websites and all the mobile templates are the same. Every unique design has its own unique responsive mobile site. Start a free trial with no credit card required and start building your own website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TECH, that's tech, to get 10% off your first purchase, and that'll let them know you came from our show. We'd like to thank Squarespace for sponsoring Out of School this week. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Okay, awesome. I love having sponsors that we actually use. That's my favorite thing.
Yeah, me too. It makes it easy to talk about. Their new iOS apps are really good. What I like about it, I have a very specific blogging workflow that I really mainly do from iOS. I do a lot of writing from my phone, oddly enough. It's usually like early in the morning when I'm feeding my kid and he's just sitting there and sucking down the bottle. And I'll just, you know, hammer out a blog post in the Byword on my iPhone. And then, you know, Byword supports copying the HTML. It'll convert the markdown to HTML. But with Squarespace, don't even have to do that. You can just copy the markdown straight into their app, and you can even schedule the post right there if you don't want to post it at 6 a.m. because most people won't click on it then. You can, like, schedule it to post at 10 a.m. So it's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's very useful for me. I always want to schedule it when the Americans wake up.
Why is that? I mean, you're trying to say the Americans are the best? Is that what you're trying to say?
I'm trying to say they're lazier than us and they don't wake up as early in the morning.
Hey, or were your go-to-bed later? I don't know. Never mind. Yeah, never mind.
Time is hard.
It is. Well, it's especially hard when you've got, like, you know, friends and, you know, 5 hours ahead of you, then 4 hours behind you. It gets really tricky and because it's really a global economy. We should just have one time zone. That would make it a lot simpler.
I keep saying Swatch internet time has got to come. It was 20 years too early.
So, yeah.
Also had problems with leap years, I believe, but apart from that.
I'm still confused by leap years. Don't even...
Yeah, I mean, humans have problems with leap years anyway. It doesn't matter. Right, so you want to talk about an actual topic?
We probably should.
Yeah. I thought one of the things that, given that we've just turned over a new form factor for iPad, one of the things that may be worth sort of revisiting a discussion about, Bradley, is cases. iPad cases.
Yes.
Because obviously, I think this time of year, people are starting to think, if you're thinking about going one-to-one or doing some kind of iPad deployment in August, September this year, now's the time to start thinking about it. And some of the things, we're going to do a series of shows later in the spring about things to think about as you approach an iOS deployment. But one of the early things to think about, obviously, is cases. Because it's... Well, I guess the way to start about it, Bradley, is that a case is kind of the thing that keeps your iPad alive. And I kind of wish it weren't so, but it is so.
Yeah, I always remember John Siracusa talking about how iOS devices are essentially kind of just the guts. And you can choose to use them just as the guts, but you're probably going to want to choose a case, and that kind of gives it personality. And he talked about how he always put his iPod Touch in, you know, a certain kind of case every time he bought one. And, you know, I've got friends that use iPhones without cases, but I'll be honest, I don't see really anyone using iPads without cases.
I'd say it's pretty rare, yeah. I think that sort of speaks to the idea that a phone is designed to be held in the hand, always, whereas the iPad is sometimes held in the hand and sometimes placed on a flat surface to work, or on your lap, or, you know, stood up on a surface or whatever. So I guess my kind of fundamental contention about iPad cases is that all of them are terrible. That's my sort of baseline pessimistic starting point of view, is that all iPad cases suck, and all you can do is find one that's not as awful as all the rest, because there are some truly terrible ones. And it's also my contention that it doesn't actually matter how much money you spend, you're not guaranteed to get a good one. I mean, some of the most expensive iPad cases I've ever seen have been some of the worst as well. So that's my, I don't know about you, but that's my default position in iPad cases. Have you ever found one you really loved?
I really like the current iPad Air Smart Case. But, you know, I like to think of it as, if I had $1 trillion and I had a closet full of iPads and iPhones that were always in sync, always had the same wallpaper, and were always ready to go, would I use a case? I would not use a case on my phone or my iPad. you ultimately do it because you're worried about it breaking and you're trying to protect your investment, or you're trying to get a little bit better of a positioning, on this kind of surface. So, yeah, I'm in the same boat. It's always like finding one that you don't hate is the best bet.
Yeah. And I think from a school point of view, I think most people thinking about iPad cases are very focused on the damage aspect, that the number one priority for using a case is so that they don't get broken when they get dropped. And that's obviously essential. I mean, I'm not saying that anybody should be cavalier with their iPad, because obviously drops can be fatal to iPads, and particularly drops onto hard surfaces that most schools have can be fatal. But I kind of speculated recently that would it be possible that you could have an iPad that didn't require a case? Is that even practically possible to build? There were some rumors not so long ago about the next iPad having what they call a sapphire screen, so the screen being made of sapphire crystal rather than Gorilla Glass. Now, Apple already makes some sapphire crystal to cover certain parts of iOS devices, namely the camera lens at the back on the iPhones, and I think the iPads too are both made of sapphire crystal, which is an incredibly hard substance, usually made for the faces of very expensive watches, and very, very hard to scratch or damage. And that would at least, I think, solve the damage issue. If you could imagine an iPad screen that could never get scratched, then okay, maybe a drop might still be dangerous to it, but for the most part you could throw it in a bag and it would be fine. But then how would you prop it up? And that's the other part of a case, is putting the iPad into a position where you can use it either hands-free or with put two hands on the screen and not have to prop the device up with one hand. And I hate to even use this word because it's so tainted by association, but the idea of possibly having a kickstand on an iPad is an interesting one to me. If you could pop something out the back that would stand the iPad up, and then you could just collapse that and throw it in a bag without having to put a case on, I would really like that. Yeah, because I love using my iPad Air without a case. I would say I have the smart cover, and I would say it's off the iPad more than it's on it.
Yeah, that's one of the how I type on it, is I will use the smart cover or the smart cover flap to prop it up at an angle, and that's how I'll crank out some writing or answer some emails. So, yeah, the idea of a kickstand could certainly alleviate that need right there, because especially the iPad Mini and then the iPad Air smart cases and smart covers, they aren't as, I guess, sturdy as maybe the iPad 2, 3, and 4 smart covers because there's one less flap. And so they're not as sturdy as they used to
be. Yeah, so they don't hold together when they're rolled as well as they used to.
Well, and then you think about the old industrial phones that we used to see, like from Nextel, and I want to say that Motorola has an Android phone that's kind of meant for the construction world, and they're terrible looking phones.
Yeah.
So that's my fear, is if we did get something that was made to be damage free, even if dropped, how ugly would it be?
Well, it would look exactly like a lot of these Android tablets that are made for kids. Gigantic rubber bumpers, and I mean that's what those phones did look like, right? But if there was a way that you could use advanced material science to still have something that looked like an iPad Air and was about the same size and weight, but had this magical material all around it that was scratch proof, that seems to me the kind of thing that Apple might do. I know nothing. I'm not saying they do, but that would be a very standout feature. You can't scratch the screen. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world where we need a case. So can I give you my theory of iPad cases?
Yeah.
My grand unified theory of all iPad cases is that there's basically only three of them. And everything you see is some variant of these basic three designs. And the names that I give to them are the folio case, the kickstand case, and the military spec case. An example of the folio case, the defining feature of a folio case is that you can put it into a low-rise typing stand as well as a vertical screen viewing stand. And the canonical example of the folio case is the original Apple iPad case, where it opened like a book and the front cover had a hinge in the middle of it, a seam where you could bend it and you could turn the case into a triangle, a right-angle triangle. And you could type flat or you could raise it up vertically and have it like a cinema screen. That's what I refer to as a folio case. And there's many, many parts or types of case that are just versions of that. Now, the smart cover is just a very minimalist version of a folio case. It's a folio case without the back, essentially. And back shells that you get for iPads are basically folio cases without the front. And many of those back shells are actually designed to work in concert with the smart cover, so that you put the smart cover on and then you put this back shell on and then you've got a full case, which is interesting, but I'm not particularly a fan of using those kind of back shells, if you like.
That's what I used prior to Apple releasing the smart case for the iPad Air for my iPad Mini and my iPad 2 and 3. I had like a smart cover compatible back shell with the smart cover, and I liked it okay. It looked terrible, though.
Yeah. Yeah, they never quite match up, do they? I mean, even the ones that are designed to look the same as the smart cover. So, yeah, those folio cases are okay. They tend to be better typing stands than viewing stands. I think because you don't want to raise the back of the iPad too high, that means that when you put that vertical piece horizontal to be the base stand, it can sometimes be a little bit unsteady. And that was certainly a big problem that we had with the first Apple iPad case, was when people stood it up to view, it was on a very narrow base and it was quite easy to tip over because of the weight that was higher up. So that's an issue with those kind of stands. But I think the reason I like them is because they make a good typing stand, and I care a lot about and do a lot of actual typing on the iPad screen. So my preference, if I have to choose, and I do have to choose because nothing's perfect, my preference is for a solid typing stand and a slightly shaky vertical stand rather than the other way around. You've used that before, the smart cover and now the smart case, so you know what I'm talking about there.
Yeah, I didn't care for the previous smart case, the one that came out, I guess that was late last year. I didn't care for that
one. Yeah, I had that one. That was the original Apple smart case, which was basically made of sort of PU material with the... It was like the cheaper of the two original smart covers, but it had a back on it and it was kind of heat sealed with seams around the edges. I had it, but I didn't like it very much. Did you ever have one?
No, I never had one because at that point, I think I'd switched to the Mini, and I don't think they had it for the Mini.
No, they didn't.
You know, and the kicker with, especially Apple's cases, it drastically increases the cost of your deployment on a per student basis. When you're looking at, is it $70 or $80 per case? So, I mean, that's something to definitely consider when you're looking at these cases, is consider the cost. You know, it's one thing for me to say, hey, I'm going to buy the iPad Air for my iPad, but if I'm having to buy 100 of these, that's tough.
Yes, it is. And particularly now that the smart case is only available with a leather finish, that puts the price up again. Now, we mentioned at the start of the show that I bought Beth an iPad Mini for Christmas, and I bought her the Apple iPad Mini smart case, which is basically the same as the iPad Air smart case, just scaled down. And I think that's actually really nice. This current generation is much, much nicer than the ones before because they fit more snugly around the device, for a start. That was one of my criticisms of the previous smart case, was it didn't actually fit the device very well. It always kind of tended to gape at one side and was easy to catch a lot of dirt in and so on. But I've been really impressed with that little one. And I've got a couple of colleagues who have iPad Airs and have the smart case that goes along with that as well. And they're pretty happy with that too. I just can't decide on the colors. I'm not sure I like any of the colors.
I went with black. Always black.
Well, black will always work, yeah. Yeah.
I want a red one, but I always hate the shade of red that Apple picks.
It's a little lurid, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know if that's their choice. I mean, that's the Project Red thing, isn't it? So maybe they're given a color to choose. That's it. Okay, so that's type number one, the folio case, and it has its benefits. I probably prefer that style of case for school because it's optimized for typing on rather than for viewing on, and I suspect you probably do more typing than viewing in most school situations, although I'm not necessarily saying that the Apple Smart Cover is right for school. In fact, I'm saying it's definitely not right for school. The Smart Case is better because it doesn't pull off the device easily, but again, as you said, Bradley, the cost of the Smart Case has to be looked at. Because it is pretty expensive compared to the cost of the device that you're buying. If you're buying 100 or 1,000 of them, you're going to want to be looking at a cheaper case, probably.
I bet your Apple rep would love for you to buy that, though, because I'm sure those things have great margins.
Oh, yeah, margins must be astronomical on those things, for sure. And I guess at some level, it would be nice if you could get them cheaper for schools. I mean, you know, we're buying all these devices. Could you cut us some slack on the thing you do have a lot of margin on, possibly? I don't know.
Well, and I'm sure they're always willing to, you know, Apple isn't one to make incredible deals with you, but especially if you're buying AppleCare, and I know that's a discussion for another day, but you know, they tend to can bend if they, depending on the size of the deployment, they can bend in certain ways.
Yeah, more so in the US than in Europe, though, because in Europe, what you're doing is you're dealing through a reseller, and resellers have terrible margins on iPad. I mean, it's killing them to sell iPads because they're not making much more than a couple of bucks on each one, I'm pretty sure. And so where resellers make their actual coins through selling you things like cases and Apple TVs and so on. So it's not super easy to get a really nice discount on a really nice case from a European reseller. I'm sure you can do it if you're buying thousands at a time, but if you're buying hundreds, you're basically paying more or less retail price for your case. That was certainly our experience. So anyway, that's case number one, the Folio case. And I think if you go to any store and look around and see what kind of cases are available, you'll see that most cases are a variant of that case or a variant of the kickstand case. And what I mean by the kickstand case is you've seen these kind of cases where, again, it opens like a book. It's got front and back cover, but there's an extra layer of material behind the iPad. And what happens is you put the outside front cover down, if you like, and then the device raises up and the inside edge of the device goes down against the inside front cover of the case so that you have a kind of A-frame shape made with the case. Typically, these things are landscape design only. There are one or two where you can rotate the iPad into portrait in that same orientation, but most of them are built just for landscape use. They optimize viewing over typing. So although you can put them into typically low position, what I tend to find is that because you've got a folded up case underneath the iPad, that the iPad becomes quite bouncy. So you're typing on something that's sort of springing back at you all the time, and that can lead to inaccuracies when typing. But if you were, say, viewing a lot of videos on your iPad or watching TV or even presenting to a small group of people at a desk, having a case that's very steady and it's vertical, in its vertical stand so that you can show a vertical screen to people nearby can be pretty helpful. Have you seen any particularly good versions of this, Bradley?
I have not. And I was just thinking, it would be nice if you could have kind of a combination of some of these cases that you could like have interchangeable parts, because I could see, again, like you said, situations where the kickstand case would be nice to have, but mm-hmm. Do I want to commit to that day in and day out?
Yeah. There's only one kickstand case that I've seen that I actually liked, and it's made by a company called Incipio, and I think it's called the Flagship Folio. Now, it's a pretty expensive case. I think even in the UK it's about £60. But what it is it's a hard plastic back shell and a hard plastic cover, and the two are connected not by like a full-length leather stitched seam like many of these things are, but they're connected by an articulated metal clip. And what you do there is instead of folding leather underneath the iPad, you have this metal bar. And what that means is that when you move it down into its lower position for more of a typing aspect, it's actually rock solid underneath. So there's no springy material underneath. It's actually angled up, held in place by an angled metal bar. It's called the Incipio Flagship Folio. It's an expensive case, but the couple of people I know that have got it are very, very happy with it. And as far as I've seen, it's the only kickstand case that I would actually use because it is solid for typing on as well as for viewing on. But it is quite thick and quite heavy and also quite expensive, although very well made as well. So if you needed something that had to get banged about a little bit, that would be a good one to choose. I don't know if they have an iPad Air version yet, though. I've seen a lot of people using these, and I think my suspicion is that kickstand cases are sort of easier to make, because it seems to me that most of the cheapest iPad cases I see are kickstand style. I don't know why that is, but it seems to me that that's the way it is. I think they're probably more durable because in use, not many parts of the case are actually under strain, Whereas with the folio case, there's a little, usually a little tab or a notch on the back of the case that has to, the outside lip of the case has to go into, and that can get worn and it can collapse easily. Whereas the kickstand case seems to be a bit more kind of long lasting because the weight of the iPad sort of keeps everything in place. I have never actually owned one of those cases. Although my other daughter, April, did get one for Christmas. It was a Logitech, I think. And I was quite impressed with that. If I had to choose one, I would probably have chosen that one because it's got a kind of nylon outer with a thin plastic shell inside, so it's pretty robust and solid. And then it does its kickstand thing. And she's pretty happy with that. But I'm not a huge fan of that kind of case, although lots of people seem to be because they are, as I say, quite cheap, as far as I can tell. The last one is the military spec case, and I'm sure you've seen these, Bradley. I mean, there is, if Batman had an iPad, this is what this is the kind of case Batman would put his iPad in. I think the classic one is the OtterBox. Would you say? That's certainly the one I've heard most
in
about.
In the Griffin Survivor case.
Griffin Survivor is the other one, isn't it? Yeah. Yep. I think the Griffin Survivors are a little bit cheaper, so they tend to be used more in school. But I have seen some schools using these exclusively. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is a slight kind of paranoia about damage. You know, if you've only just kind of by hair's breadth got to have an iPad deployment and there's been a huge big fuss about what happens when they get broken, then quite a lot of schools who have had to produce a very robust response to that question have said, well, we're going to buy these military spec cases and there's no way the device can be broken. And that's kind of the card that they play against people using that argument against them, which I understand. I mean, I think if that is something that you're critically concerned about, then there is a way to solve that problem. However, my biggest complaint about these cases are, well, there are several complaints about them, but the main one is that they basically ruin the ergonomics of the iPad. That the size and the weight that an iPad has once it's inside one of these cases is in many cases more than double the weight of the iPad itself, just for that extra protection.
And you're basically, in my opinion, prepaying against damage.
Yes. And you're paying for it every time you use the device because you're not getting the same experience.
Yeah, and I just struggle spending that kind of money because I've even seen some of these that are even more expensive than Apple's case. You know, that you can you can find them in retail close to $100. And I think a lot of parents, when they're buying their kids iOS devices for gifts, immediately think we've got to have these Griffin cases or these OtterBoxes. And while that may be true, I always look at it and say, okay, if you're planning on spending an extra $100 per iPad to get, let's say this, even like another $120, and you're going to buy a nice case, a very durable case, the military grade, and AppleCare. On top, you just really go all out to make sure you have no damage. Well, let's say over the next 3 years, you buy them two iOS devices. How much more have you spent to protect these things than if you just maybe got a regular case and winged it?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, I suppose the other aspect in that discussion, Bradley, is that AppleCare Plus is now available for iPads as well. I don't know if that was true in a long time in the US, but it's just with the release of the iPad Air, that's now been available in the UK as well. So for a little bit extra on your AppleCare, you can also have, you can essentially have an invisible case that's insurance, right? You pay your excess on the insurance and you just get your iPad fixed at the store. There are some schools I've spoken to where their insurance policy, their insurance underwriters have told them your insurance is invalid unless you have a mil-spec case on your iPads, which I think is crazy town. I mean, that's I think there's a growing kind of paranoia amongst insurance companies about school iPad deployments because I know that some schools where they have made a really big deal about how well insured their iPads are tend to somewhat expectedly experience quite a high breakage rate because when people have been told that all risks are covered, then why not take some risks, right? Whereas schools that don't make a big song and dance about insurance policy tend not to have such high risks or high rates of damage, shall I say.
Well, and I think there's a big difference in trying to protect your iPad from breakage and then trying to protect it from a scratch on the back of it. And if you're just trying to, like, you know, me personally, I'm really just trying to keep mine looking brand new. I don't need the military grade case. But if you are, you know, I'm not, I don't drop mine. I hope I don't. I haven't dropped it yet. And so there's a big difference. You know, if you're just trying to protect, if you're just trying to protect it, you know, a scratch here and there, use that in your judgment when you buy cases.
Yeah. I mean, at some level, what you're doing is you and I are trying to sort of protect the resale value of our device, rather than defend it against malicious or careless use. There is one situation, though, where such a case is obviously of a lot of value, and this is in any situation where people are using iPads with children who maybe have motor control problems or other kind of sometimes emotional and behavioural problems as well, where they might get very frustrated or angry and throw the device in a fit of frustration. And I've certainly talked to some schools who cater for a lot of pupils in that situation, where it's the only case that they could possibly consider using. And that makes perfect sense there, because obviously that's a very specialized situation and there are extremes of use for the device that you would not normally see in a mainstream school. So that makes a certain amount of sense as well. There are also other cases where you have, they deliberately try and adapt a device for children with motor control problems. So they put big, big handles around the device or whatever as well. And those are a kind of special class, and I think it's really up to the people helping those children to sort of specify the correct case for the correct people in that scenario. But in terms of a large, you know, broad-scale deployment, I think you're kind of looking at one or other of these choices. I suppose the other big complaint about the military spec case is it was very hard to type on an iPad with that kind of case on. I've seen some of them. I think the Griffin Survivor comes with a little kind of stand clipped onto it that you can twist around and prop it up for typing on, but not all of them have that, and that can be pretty difficult. I think the OtterBox ones tend to have gaskets over all of the ports and switches as well, so that they're very splash proof. That can be a real problem if you're using the camera, and not because they interfere with the camera necessarily, but because when you're shooting with the camera, you've always got to hold the gasket open. And if you forget to do that and it flips back, then you can ruin a take on your video or whatever. So that's something to bear in mind as well. If you don't have to use these cases, I kind of really recommend not using them. But, you know, again, go to the shop, look at all the cases, and if you find any particular kind of case that isn't a variant of one of these three, I would love to know about it so I can expand my taxonomy of iPad cases, because I think at the end of the day, these are really the two designs that most people have thought about. And I think it would be nice to have some other options. I'm sure the day is not done yet.
Before we move on, let's take a moment to thank our last sponsor of the day, Jamp Software, with their great Casper Suite. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs. Their Casper Focus app for the iPad allows teachers to quickly focus students' attentions on iPads, conduct secure exams within an app, select specific Apple TVs assigned to their class, and choose and distribute iBooks. They can also prompt AirPlay. You can visit, if you're going to be at the be in London soon for the BETT event, they'll be at booth E360. Or if you're planning on being in Orlando, Florida for the FETC booth, event, they'll be at booth 1363. So if you're going to be at either one of those events that's in London, E360, or in Orlando, it's booth 1363. You know, I'll be at ISTE this summer in Atlanta, so I'll get to hang out with those guys then. Yeah, it was real fun last year when ISTE was in a city that wasn't 2 hours from me that I visit probably on a monthly basis.
Nice.
Yeah, it's always nice when somewhere fun you haven't gone before.
Yeah, you need to have that Hawaii more often.
Yeah, you're telling me. And the year that my wife is not going to be pregnant and could travel with me, we get to drive to Atlanta.
Yay.
Literally, I was there 2 weeks ago.
It'd be like having it in Glasgow.
Yes, true, yeah. It's like, come on, because last year it was in San Antonio, Texas, and that was fun. So, yeah, but the Jamp folks are great to talk to, so if you're looking, want to see kind of more hands-on how it works, go by and check out their booths. You know, it's funny, we're talking about cases, kind of circle back around. Mm-hmm. When people ask me my recommendation on cases, I never send them to Amazon. I always tell them to go to, like, their local Mac Authority, mm-hmm. Apple Store, and use them and touch them and talk to the people there. Because I think looking at a case and, like, seeing how it works is drastically different.
Yep. absolutely agree. Apple Store is really good for this as well, although I have to say they don't carry a very big range, but they do have more than they used to. I mean, it used to be you could only get the smart cover and that was it. And they obviously carry the Apple cases, but there's now a few other ones as well. And one of the ones that they have kind of focused on, bizarrely, at least in my local Apple store, is keyboard cases. So they've got the Logitech, help me out with the name of it, the thin keyboard cover or something like that, and a couple of other ones as well. I actually bought one just before Christmas because I wanted to kind of see what all the fuss was about. If there is actually fuss, I'm not that sure, but there are certainly some people who are grand devotees of iPad keyboard cases. So I got the Logitech, the keyboard folio, I think it is, or something. It's kind of like a nylon-y red, in this case, cover with a Bluetooth keyboard built into the front. So it's like a variant of the kickstand case, if you like. I don't know if you've ever used a keyboard case, Bradley, specifically
I
a
have.
Case.
Yes, what do you think? I used it for a day, and I hated it. And I think mainly because I do like to type on the iPad so much.
Yeah.
And it's not that obviously I am faster on my MacBook Air, certainly. But I've gotten pretty fast on my iPad, and I think that comes with practice. And yes. So I think a lot of people just assume they need a keyboard if they're going to type a lot. Mm-hmm. When if they would just give it a little practice, I think they could probably get by without one. Because, you know, again, 90% of the time I wouldn't use the keyboard case, maybe even 95% of the time. So why do I want to have a case with a keyboard attached that's going to make my device drastically thicker on it 100% of the time?
Yeah, I mean, that was more or less exactly my thinking as well. Now, I kind of felt like it did enhance the typing use case of the iPad, but it came at the cost of basically ruining every other use case I had for my iPad, which are several, right? It's not just you're typing or you're watching a movie. You could be typing, you could be reading, you could be surfing the web, watching a movie, yes. Drawing on your iPad, lots of different things. It's simply not true that there's only two modes of use, typing or not typing. It's much more nuanced than that. And I think I didn't feel like it was a good trade-off for me to have this thing carried around all the time just to enhance one aspect of the iPad at the cost of a severe detriment to many other aspects of using the iPad. And I completely agree with you as well, Bradley, that typing's about practice. It doesn't matter whether you just put a new keyboard on your Mac Pro, you know, and it's a different design from your previous keyboard, you're going to have to practice at that one too. And I find when I had this Logitech case on that I had to practice, because if you think about it, an iPad keyboard case, the keyboard is constrained to be no bigger than the outside dimensions of the iPad, because it's got to fit in a case the size of the iPad, right? So I had to essentially relearn how to type on this new keyboard layout, which is much, much smaller than my standard Apple layout. And I thought to myself, if I was a new person coming to iPad right now, would it make sense for me to spend my time learning how to type on this iPad plastic keyboard edition? Or would it make more sense for me just to spend my time learning how to type straight on the iPad? And I think, you know, it's not hard to make the case that you'd be much better served over the long haul spending your time learning how to type on the iPad screen, because that's always going to be there.
And one of our past sponsors, Tap Typing, has a great app for the iPad that's basically a typing trainer, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But
it's a great app.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you think about like 10 years from now, or even 5 years from now, the kids that have kind of grown up with iPads, how much faster will they be on iPad typing than they will be on traditional keyboard typing?
Yeah. Yep. And I think the other thing to kind of realize that I had not realized this, because I'd only ever used an Apple full size Bluetooth keyboard with my iPad. And I'm already good at that keyboard, so it was fine. But when I was dealing with this smaller keyboard that was a Bluetooth keyboard, when you use a Bluetooth keyboard, many of the software supports that are given to you when you use the virtual keyboard are not enabled. So autocorrect, for example, doesn't operate. Or certainly wasn't operating with his Logitech keyboard. And some of the, you know, extra features like the double space to hit the period on your typing, that wasn't available either, and various other things. So I find it in some ways to be more of a hindrance than just using the software keyboard. So I'm kind of pretty down in those kind of cases. I'm not a big fan of them. I know some people who are absolute devotees of a keyboard case. But I think, you know, if you're going to learn a new small keyboard, why not learn the keyboard of the future and just type on the glass? Or get a full-size Bluetooth keyboard and take that with you, which is actually what I do. You know.
Yeah, you know, the times you're going to travel and think, I'd like to have a keyboard to type on, the times just take your Bluetooth keyboard from your desk, and when you get back, repair it with your Mac. And you don't make your case permanent for the exceptional, you know, the exception use case.
I agree. There is a I think it's a Logitech keyboard which has three Bluetooth pairing profiles on it. I can't remember the name of it. We'll try and find it for show notes. But it's essentially got a switch on it where you can switch it to one of three Bluetooth pairings. So you can have it paired to your Mac, paired to your iPad, or paired to your phone just with the flick of a switch. And I'm quite interested in that keyboard because I've actually got two Bluetooth keyboards on my desk right now, one for my Mac and one for my iPad. I'm sure I could slim that down a little bit. So you want to move on to our next topic, Bradley? We're going to briefly talk about charging.
Yeah, let's do that.
Which is another big issue for schools as well. Tell me how you charge your iPads.
I have a very inexpensive system. So, again, all the iPads, when they need charging and also on the weekends, they come back to my office. And I've got some shelving in a closet in the backside of my office. They kind of built me a long hallway. When I say they, I mean our administration. And I've got shelves with AC outlets just continually down through it. And I have a bunch of surge protectors, and I have a bunch of chargers plugged in there, and I kind of separate the iPads out by grade. And so I just kind of stack them on top of each other and plug in the chargers, and I'm good to go. Mm-hmm. It's not the most elegant solution, but it's really, really inexpensive. Just built some shelves and, you know, had an electrician wire up some outlets for us.
And you're just using the Apple charger?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's essentially what we do as well. I mean, in our deployment, because it's one-to-one and it's also older kids, what we'll do is, for most of our kids, more than half of our kids take the iPad home. So what we do the first day of the term or the second day when they bring back their paperwork is we say, here's your charger and cable, go away and charge it at home. And for the most part, that works fine. You know, most kids will charge the iPad at home, bring it to school. Obviously, it runs all day, no problem. I love how we take that for granted now, by the way. But the iPad will run all day without any problem, and then they charge it the next day. So essentially, problem solved, right? There's a couple of things that we've noticed over the years where that's been difficult. One is for children of parents who are separated and who move between two parents' houses during the week, it's not uncommon for them to forget to pack their charger when they move houses, if you like. And sometimes it'll be like, oh, well, I left the charger at my mum's house and I was at my dad's house last night or whatever, and they don't have a charger. So we try to be, you know, obviously compassionate into that situation, but also try to kind of get the message home that that's something that has to be packed along with whatever else they're packing for that move during the week. Occasionally, kids will forget to charge their iPad at home. Happens. Usually only happens once or twice. Otherwise, once you spend a day without your iPad at school, it's a pretty miserable day, so you tend to remember after that. It's not been a widespread problem, but it is a wee bit more of a problem with our fourth generation iPads because it's very hard for me to give them a kind of emergency charge because the battery is so large in those devices that they kind of end up sitting the whole day on a charger in school if I can even find one to spare them, which is not always the case. But yeah, that's how we deal with most of our charging situations. And like you, in the rest of our classrooms, it doesn't come back to me, but what the teachers in the class will do is they will charge the iPads and need charge that night just in their classrooms using a power strip. And I've got most of them in a box in my classroom, but we gave out maybe four or five chargers per classroom. And it's quite interesting because a lot of people think that when you're running an iPad program, you have to have capacity to charge every single device simultaneously all the time. And in fact, particularly in a one-to-one situation, I think you don't really need that amount of capacity. Because when you're in a one-to-one situation, the use of the iPad is highly differentiated. And what I mean by that is that everybody's doing something different with it. If you're in a very cart-based situation where you roll the iPads in, you do 1 hour of, I don't know, brushes, drawings, then everybody's used up 1 hour's worth of brushes battery use. Does that make sense? Like everybody's doing the same thing, so they use the same amount of battery every hour. At the end of the day, all the devices will be at about the same battery level, and eventually you're going to have to charge them all up at about the same time. But if you have a one-to-one situation where you're highly differentiated in what you do with the iPad, then what we have found is that, in fact, usually most days, there's maybe two or three or four or five, at the most, iPads out of the class that need to be charged that night. And the teacher will just, at the end of the day, say, whose battery is less than 40%? And then those people get to charge their iPad that night. And then the next day, those people won't use their iPad enough in any one day to use 60% of the battery. So the next set of people whose iPads are now below 40% get to charge, and so on. So you can actually sort of interleave charging over multiple days for younger kids, because they're not using the iPad maybe quite so continuously during their school day as older kids are. So we only have about five chargers in each classroom, and whoever needs it gets it on any one day.
Yeah, 40% is my baseline as well. Yeah. I tell our teachers that during the week, if your iPads are 40% or less at the end of the day, they bring them to me to charge them. Otherwise, you know, obviously, again, Fridays are the exception because we charge them all.
Yeah.
But yeah, 40% seems like a good baseline. And we, especially on the ones we've got this year, all of our new minis, they generally last all week. And even when I get them on Fridays, they're just now then at 40%. Now, our older iPad 2s, which are in their second year of use, generally by Tuesday or Wednesday, they are ready to be charged.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I suppose that the message that I have from our is that it's so much not a problem that I don't even know the numbers to tell you. You know, it's not even something we monitor because it's so little of a big deal. It's interesting to watch some people make different decisions about this. Now, I think one of the things that we have to be aware of is that there are some schools who are, the physical location that they're in puts them at high risk of theft. And many people look at charging and on-premises security as two sides of the same coin. And I think that's quite sensible, actually, because if you become known as a school that has iPads and you're in a high crime area, then you're probably going to be more of a target, and it makes good sense to take some precautions around that. So there are some devices you can get. I know of one called Lock and Charge, which is kind of like a metal basket that you put the iPads in, and then they go into a locking box, which then also charges them. Things like that, where you combine the charging aspect and the physical security aspect of the device on premises in one solution. And those can be quite a smart solution as well. There are other ones where they're basically charging stations and they don't offer any additional security unless you build them into some kind of cupboard or something. I've never been tempted by any of these, mainly because of their price. I don't know if you've ever priced these things, Bradley, but they are very expensive.
Well, and again, you just go back and it's like how many more iPads could you buy, or how nice of a case could you buy? Or I mean, anytime you can cut out, you know, think through your deployment and don't just take what the reseller or what Apple is suggesting, and think through how you'll use these day to day and what your process will be and how you'll charge them and where you'll charge them. Do you need some of these expensive items?
Yes, and this is true. And there are other situations as well where, you know, some schools I've been to where they're part of like a community learning center, where people who are not necessarily part of the school do come into the building from time to time, and they have, and again, different security challenges also. But in a regular school situation, you know, how likely is it that you're going to have all your iPads heisted in one go? Now, for some schools, it is very likely. I'm not decrying that, or I'm not pretending it's not true, because for some schools, it is true. The approach we took was that because our iPads are charged in the classroom and they're distributed all over the building, then by the time any break-in thief was able to find all of the devices, we hope our alarm system would have kicked in and there would be some response at that point. And even so, only about 30 to 40 of our devices actually stay on site each night. The vast majority of them are away in lots of different houses, and the chances of all of those being stolen is basically zero, because not everybody in the school is going to have their house broken into at the same time. So you got to make a kind of risk assessment on that. And I think there are some people who have, you know, very stringent security requirements. Other people, not so much.
And our insurance, like our actual school's insurance, actually covers like theft. One of the things they always ask me every year is to kind of figure up the total value of all of our equipment, networking equipment, and things like that. And so that way, if our school did burn down or we did have a massive break-in over the weekend, everything we owned was stolen, every laptop, every you know, Arrow Hive access point, everything we had with stolen was gone, that our insurance would kick in and help us with that. So it's also something to consider.
Yeah. And I think there may be provisions in your school insurance policy for what you have to do to secure those devices overnight. There may be some requirements on you there as well. So in the end, it may make sense for you to spend the money on those kind of charging and locking stations because you will get a cut in your insurance premium or something instead, or you may get much less of a deductible or something. I'm not an insurance expert. I haven't even really dealt with it. I've kind of had the same question you've had, Bradley. How much stuff is in this building? And then somebody else has dealt with the rest of it. So, it's an interesting one. And I think if I was beginning a deployment again, I would be biased towards thinking, let's see what I can get away without having, rather than saying, what are all the things I must have? And for goodness sake, never ask your reseller what are all the things you must have for your deployment, because you know what you're going to get there, which is a massive list of things that you absolutely must have, most of which you absolutely probably don't want. So something to be aware of. Obviously, some of the mobility carts as well. I mean, we're kind of, you know, or at least I'm kind of down on iPad cart deployments a little bit, but some of the carts that you can buy do also have charging integrated, so you plug the cart into the wall and then you plug the devices into the cart and then they charge that way as well.
And they're expensive. But
they're very, very expensive. And I think at the end of the day, I mean, if you think about the fourth generation iPad, let's say, or even the iPad Air to a certain extent, plugging it in for 20 minutes during the day isn't really worth anything. Right. I mean, how much you maybe get like 8% battery added, 8% capacity added to your battery charge for any 20-minute period that it's on charge. But it's not like a laptop, right? You don't need to. It's not constantly got to be sucking power out the wall just to stay alive during the school day anymore. Those days are past. So think about it as I'm charging them at the end of the day, maybe at the end of several days, and it's probably okay that I return them to the base to charge them. Because it will actually happen so infrequently at most grade levels that you don't necessarily need to have that capacity in every classroom for every 10 minutes of the day that you can possibly get some juice into that battery, because you simply don't need to charge them that often. It's not a critical part of the deployment in the way that, say, Wi-Fi is, for example.
Well, and think about your workflows with these. I think Bretford actually sells them. You know, and Apple, and if you are interested, Apple does sell these. It's a company called Bretford, and Apple resells them. I know here in the U.S. they resell them, and you can roll them into your lease, so you don't have to, you know, say write a check for it individually. Yeah. But so let's say you are doing a cart-based deployment, and let's say you have a, you know, roaming teacher that's taking them from classroom to classroom doing lessons. So think about, you know, she collects the iPad, or he or she collects the iPad at the end of class one. You know, maybe even plugs them in to the lightning port, you know, then locks up the case, goes out the door to the next class. What does she do, or he or she do, when she gets to the next class? Immediately hand them out again. It's not even like that she's going in there and plugging them into the wall for 5 minutes. I mean, most of the time, it's just almost a travel case.
Yes, the main purpose of a car is to stop you dropping them while you walk around the school. And charging is just a nice thing to have at the end of the day. Now, maybe the beauty of it is that you can leave it in whatever classroom you're in at the end of the day and your charging infrastructure has gone with you. Yeah, I can see the point in that as well. But, you know, during the school day, you're going to want to have those things in use as much as possible. So, I mean, every iPad comes with a charger. Think about what you can do with that before you go spending $10,000 on custom charging infrastructure.
We, for our deployment, we have like those rolling laptop cases that like executives use that travel a lot, that they don't have to carry their bag to the airport. And I can fit 18 to 20 iPad 2s in there with a thin rubber case pretty comfortably. Mm-hmm. And certainly I could probably fit 30 iPad minis in there. And I spent $40 on each of those. And I think the Bretford carts may be close to $2,000.
It's good experience from your smuggling life.
Yes, yes.
So how we get iPads back from America.
Now, the thing I would add here is if you're going to be buying extra chargers and cables, is to make sure that they're authorized. You know, you don't want to go to Slick Deals and get the deal that's $1 for three lightning cables, because they are generic knockoffs. And I've actually seen them mess up an iPhone. I really have. I know people in the past thought that was kind of a myth, but I have seen one iPhone where it was literally messed up because they were using a cable they bought off the internet. So if you don't want to buy Apple's cables, Amazon sells a pretty good USB wall charger, and the Lightning cables that are authorized from Apple. You want to look for the made for iPad, iPhone, iPod logo on the box.
Yep. Yep. I've got a number of Amazon cables. In fact, my iPad is charging from one right now. And I can't say enough good things about them. They've got big, robust connectors. They're not the little skinny Apple connectors. They're big, easy to grip. Also important for younger children. Bigger is easier for them to grip. And I've got a couple of short ones, and I've got one 6-foot cable as well, which is great. I think, I don't know if this is true or not, but my impression is that the Lightning cable is much more important to have an authorized one than the 30-pin cable ever was.
I have not heard that, and certainly thinking it's a new technology, that could very much be true.
It feels like there's more brains in the Lightning cable. I'm not sure if this is absolutely true, but certainly I suppose in any early generation of new technology, it's harder to reliably fake it. You know, I mean, 2 or 3 years ago, I was buying, you know, buckets of 60 30-pin cables for 60 pence each from Amazon for our older iPads. And I'll be honest with you, if you bought 30 of them, 25 of them would work and 5 of them would be broken in the box. I mean, they were terrible quality, but they were so cheap compared to the official cables that it made total sense to buy them. I would not do that with a Lightning cable right now. I would maybe do it 5 years from now, once Lightning is better understood by the Chinese knockoff merchants, and they know how to do it safely and reliably. I would maybe consider it then, but today I'm definitely looking for a legit official, either Apple or Amazon or otherwise made for iPad or iPhone cables, just to be on the safe side.
Yeah, I agree.
Cool. So yeah, don't spend a lot of money on charging. Put a lot of money into your case instead, if you can afford it. I forgot to recommend the case that we actually bought for school. It's called the Belkin Cinema Stripe Folio case. And it's actually an interesting case because it is a combination of kickstand and folio. So it will fold back around and be a low typing stand in a folio style, but it also can pop up like a kickstand as well. So we're pretty happy with that case so far. We've only had one broken device so far, and that was because someone's rather large dog stood on their iPad, which cracked it. It's apparently a very large dog. So, yeah, that's the case that we've used, and pretty happy with it so far. And I guess as iPad Air cases start to filter through, there maybe will be some new options as well. So we'll keep a wee eye on that and see if anything good turns up. If you have cases you love, send us your feedback and we'll maybe do a follow-up later on.
Yeah, it almost, you could see a whole website dedicated to iPad case reviews.
There is one, I forget, is it iLounge or something, where they have like this massive database of all cases. But the problem with cases is that they come in and out of production so often. There's a few companies, obviously Logitech and the Belkins of this world, who make product lines and stick with them for a long time, but you know, many of the cheaper cases that don't necessarily have a brand, you know, you find 100 of them on Amazon and then you never find them again, which is another good reason not to go to Amazon for your case, Bradley, as you said, because you often don't really know what kind of quality you're getting. In some cases you're getting a pretty terrible thing sent straight from China. Of course, almost everything sent from China at some point or another, but I suppose the other thing you want is, if you buy a bunch of cases, you want to know you can get more in the future if you need to. And if you're buying off-brand stuff that doesn't have a name on it, you might not be able to find similar quality cases in the future, which is something to think about in the long term too. Are we done? We're way over time today. Too many holiday stories.
Yeah, no, I think we're done. It's a good show. It's one of those like detail type shows that you don't think about a whole lot, but it can if you get things like this wrong, you could potentially add a lot of cost to your deployment.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of donkey work part of being an iOS admin. It's not the most fun part, you know, looking at hundreds of different iPad cases and other stuff. It's not as much fun as setting up an MDM server, for example. But in many ways, like getting the case choice wrong, I know of some deployments in the UK where it almost broke their entire deployment that they got a bad case. And there was a big story in the newspapers about a school in England where they broke half their iPads. And what the follow-up story to that was that the breakage rate was 50%, and then they changed their case and their breakage rate went down to 2%. But they are now known as the school that broke half their iPads. So it's something you can get badly wrong. But again, a wee bit like Wi-Fi, Bradley, you get no points for getting it right. you only get negative points for getting it wrong.
That's true.
Yep. Okay, let's wrap up. What have you got? We've got two sponsors.
Yeah.
Let's say thanks to Squarespace.
And Jamf. Yeah, thanks to those guys for, you know, happy to have Squarespace on board. I know they sponsor a lot of podcasts, and happy to have them on board to sponsor Out of School. Again, the all-in-one platform to make a great, easy website, starting at plans at $8 a month. Again, I know there are a lot of free options, but if you're going to run a blog and you're going to, you know, write on it continuously, or if you need a website for your restaurant, I've been tweeting about that, about terrible restaurant websites. Again, just please look at Squarespace. It's so easy, it's so simple, and it just works. Again, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TECH. And again, thanks to the folks at Jamf Software as well. You can find more about them at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com.
The best thing with Squarespace is their mobile websites don't look like iOS 6.
Yes, that is true.
To the rest of the internet. Okay, so where can people find us online? You can check out the brand new redesigned spears.org, my blog. I actually wrote something on it as well over Christmas, a little retrospective of 2013. I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter.
And you can find me on Twitter at Bradley Chambers and on the web at chambersdaily.com. And by the time this show comes out, I'll probably have two guest appearances of other podcasts. I'll be on the most recent Technical Difficulties, and as well as the Mac Power Users podcast. And so Technical Difficulties is the Reborn Generational podcast. And so I'll have a link to that in the show notes. And I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with the Mac Power Users over at 5x5. So in the Technical Difficulties one, we're talking about setting up home Wi-Fi and kind of the caveats to get into that. And on Mac Power Users, it's surprise, surprise, photo management.
Yay. Okay. Good stuff. Well, thanks everybody for coming back for another year. We're looking forward to 2014, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Have a good week, everybody.